would do. He tucked it into his pocket and went into the study. The guards hadn't looked behind the tiny curtains during their search, which was sloppy work. He pulled them open again, revealing the broken window beyond. He was just readying himself to squeeze back outside when his eye fell to the platter of food still on the desk. Roast beef, crispy potatoes cooked in goose fat, quail on truffled aspic, bull's brain pie, candied fruits on the side, and a jug of heavy red wine. He licked his lips and glanced at the door. Well, it was locked, wasn't it? And the only key was on the dead man in the bedroom. No reason for Clisson to be back any time soon, and Mudslug was likely nowhere near the vault yet. The fire was growing in the hearth, and the room was getting warm. He thought of the climb ahead, and the bitter wind blowing through the broken pane. It was no decision at all, really. Grubb wiped his bloody hands on his trousers, sat down at the desk, and jammed a chunk of roast beef in his mouth. Being a hero was hungry work. 97. What about your oath? Cade's question whispered in Garrick's mind as he walked through the hive of scampering servants beneath the main feasting halls. Scrubber boys hurried this way and that, butlers snapped orders at their subordinates, and cooks sweated over cauldrons of soup, all in the light of a huge fire that cast the shadows of turning hogs across the grey brick walls. Those who noticed Garrick looked away at the sign of the double-barred cross. Nobody hindered the iron guard. What about your oath? What if Aaron was right? What if they could spirit the ember blade away? Wasn't that slim hope worth the gamble? Didn't he have to try? Perhaps, perhaps not. The wording of the Dawn Warden's oath was muddy and archaic, updated piecemeal over the centuries as the language evolved. It had been interpreted many different ways. The Dawn Warden's decision to depose King Danner the Moon-Touched was only taken after some masterful rhetoric from Caelan the Rhymist persuaded them they were not breaking their oaths by doing it. But Garrick was no scholar, and there were no other Dawn Wardens to advise him. All he knew was that he couldn't risk the Ember Blade falling into Prince Otico's hands. Let Aaron try for the grand prize, flush with the naivety and enthusiasm of youth. Garrick would hedge their bets in case he failed. He'd protect the Ember Blade by returning it to the bosom of the land from which it sprang, to lie beneath an incalculable weight of stone for future generations of Ossians to unearth. If the legends were true, it was indestructible. And if they were not, it was still better than the alternative. The Crodans wouldn't have it. At all costs, never that. He tugged his collar up over his throat and strode on. The memory of torture stabbed him with each step, the pain in his body as nothing next to the pain in his mind. His jaw set hard as he thought of Clisson, the bright tip of a burning poker reflected in his round spectacles. That soft, breathy voice asking questions, 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 promising to stop the agony if he gave up the others, if he'd betray all he was and all he'd ever been. Garrick's mouth twitched in a bitter smile. Small chance of that. He'd welcomed the pain, wanted it. He passed through the sweltering kitchens into the corridors beyond, which led to pantries and storerooms. Racks of meat hung in cold chambers, and there were shelves lined with hundreds of jars of honey and jam, bread and cheese. He counted the doors until he reached the one he wanted. Behind it, he expected to find a dozen amberline barrels, each of them two-thirds full of ellerite oil. Enough to destroy a sizable chunk of Hammerholt and burn the rest. Certainly, it would kill everyone in the feasting halls above, including the prince and General Dakin. Maybe the chaos would ease Aaron's task, or perhaps the blast would bring down a tower on their heads. Either way, it wouldn't stay Garrick's hand. He'd been too long on this course to change it. unless the barrels had never made it out of the vintner's yard, unless they'd been delivered to a different storeroom, unless he was too late, having been delayed too long in his cell, and they'd already been moved elsewhere. Aspects, if you ever had any love for this land, if you're there at all, be with me now. Azra, Lord of War, let those barrels be where I need them to be. He opened the door. A servant, emerging from a pantry down the corridor, gave him a curious look, and Garrick glared at him until he hurried off. Beyond the door was a chilly stone chamber, lit by a lantern hanging near the entrance. Racks of bottles ran along one wall, and ale barrels were stacked wherever they'd fit, with a narrow winding aisle left between them. He shut the door behind him, took up the lantern, and made his way in, searching for the telltale crest of the Amberline vineyards. Walking through a crowd of servants disguised as an iron guardsman hadn't worried him in the least, but anxiety tightened his guts as he cast his light about and saw no sign of what he was looking for. But those barrels had to be here. They had to. There. A dusty blanket had been thrown over a small stack of barrels against one wall. Amberline didn't like the cold. They must be the barrels he sought. He hurried over, took up the corner of the covering, and ripped it away with desperate hope. His face fell slowly as he looked on what was beneath. More ale barrels, that was all. The Amberline wasn't here. Maybe it never had been. Or maybe it lay in a different storeroom, one of a dozen scattered throughout the keep. It didn't matter. He'd never find them now. He had no map, and had only memorized the small part of it that he needed. He could search all night and find nothing, and when his escape was discovered, as it would be soon, no disguise would save him. Black despair turned to boiling rage. All his planning, all his life, had come to naught, thwarted by a friend's betrayal and a twist of fate. All he wanted was to free his people. All he wanted was to make them stand up for themselves. "Damn you, Azra," he thought furiously. "Damn you and the rest of the Nine. Your people cry out for you and you do nothing. Well, if you will not, then I will." Nothing left. No grand destruction, no heroic end, no escape. Just like Salt Fork, he'd been undone by the fears of weak men. But he knew where the prince and General Dakin feasted, and he still had his sword. If he couldn't have victory, then he'd still have red vengeance. His eyes dark coals of hatred, he stalked from the storeroom, his mind set on murder. 98. Clisson! Clisson's shoulders tensed as the commander's brandy-roughened bark stopped him in his tracks. He took a moment to compose himself, relaxed his scowl and turned. The commander was standing by a doorway, a cigar in one hand and a glass in the other. Next to him, as ever, was that greasy snake Betran. Evidently they'd stepped out of their feast to discuss some secret matter. Just Clisson's luck to bump into them. The commander switched his cigar to his other hand and crooked a finger at Clisson, summoning him like a naughty child. Clisson kept his expression bland, letting the indignity slide off him. The commander could play his power games if he wished. His days were numbered, and that number was small. "Commander," he said politely as he came over, masking his loathing with an ease born of years of practice. "Head Administrator Betran?" The commander was once a square-jawed athletic man who'd become fat and saggy with decades of rich food and soft living. He had the sour, sharp scent of the aged, and his hands were speckled with liver spots. An eye patch covered one eye, which had tended to wander since the stroke. "Assad singing treasonous songs to the prince," he hissed angrily, keeping his voice low. "Isn't that exactly the sort of thing you're here to prevent?" Betran smirked at that. He was dark-haired, slender, and bookishly handsome, with his pencil moustache and his immaculate jacket. He was also a shameless flatterer. Pull out his tongue and you'd find it black to the root with boot polish. Clisson would have loved to pull out his tongue. "I am looking into it, Commander," Clisson said. "The Prince is incensed," the Commander continued, "and I see your moronic subordinate is blundering hither and thither with a group of watchmen in tow, questioning all and sundry. We're meant to be invisible, Clisson, behind the scenes. There are representatives of half the civilized world here tonight. At least try to maintain an illusion of competence."
"It's all in hand, Commander," said Clisson. "Or at least it would be if you'd shut up and let me get on with my job."
"While you're here, Overwatchman," said Betran in that fey, airy manner that made Clisson dream of signing his execution warrant, "I have a question."
"Oh, you do, do you?"
"And what is that?" he said wearily.
"Some of my men were turned away from the North Tower earlier. Apparently you ordered that nobody be allowed inside. I wonder what you're doing in there."
"I wonder what business your clerks had in such a remote and unoccupied part of the fortress," Clisson replied.
"Answer the question, Clisson," snapped the Commander. "What's in the tower?"
"Insurance," said Clisson. "Something only to be used in the direst emergency. The Prince's safety is more important than preserving the image of the Empire. And because I'll end my days in a work camp in Ozak if a hair on his head is harmed, which will be a pleasant fate compared to what you'll suffer." The Commander's expression faltered as he realized what Clisson had done. He knew what was in the tower, but he couldn't say a word, so he would be able to feign ignorance if anything went wrong. On such hypocrisy rests our empire.
"You disgust me, Clisson," the Commander said. "You've always disgusted me."
"Your honesty is as commendable as it is rare," said Clisson with a hateful smile. "But it's what the Chancellor thinks that's important, isn't it? I imagine he'll be quite impressed when he hears I caught the last Dawn Warden. Now, you must excuse me. I'm busy protecting the Empire." With that, he made his escape, leaving the senile old fool and his pet seething in his wake. Such open insubordination was reckless and ill-advised, but by the Primus it felt good. Besides, the Commander had already made his feelings about Clisson clear to anyone who'd listen, and it hadn't stopped him yet. Once Garrick swung from the gallows, he'd be untouchable. Unless Garrick's followers managed to foul up the Prince's wedding. Then the blame would fall squarely on Clisson, and the Commander, who was ultimately responsible for the Iron Hands operations in Ossia, would go down with him. Only Betran would escape unblemished. The administrative arm of the Iron Hand had nothing to do with security, so a catastrophe here would virtually guarantee his succession. If that happened, missing out on promotion would be the least of Clisson's worries. He thought of Lisi and Juna, his golden-haired daughters. He thought of his beautiful wife and the fine home she'd curated at vast expense. He thought of silly old Baron Pickles. He'd lose it all if he couldn't root out whatever plot was afoot tonight. The idea quickened his heart and made him desperate, so he crushed it down again. "The things we value make us weak. Now is not the time. Now I am authority." He found Hart near the armory, limping fast towards his next destination, with a harried underwatchman trailing behind him.
"A few servants saw the Sard and her companion heading for the lower levels," he reported as soon as he saw Clisson. It was a refreshing change to have Hart be efficient instead of sulky and obstructive.
"Did you search down there?"
"We did and found no sign. But there is something else. All the privies on the lower levels are backing up."
Clisson gave him a dry look that communicated exactly how many seconds he had left to explain himself.
"The sewers are flooded," said Hart. "I don't know what it means, but the servants say it's never happened before. They don't think the Prince's guests will notice, since they're all on the higher floors, but it's out of the ordinary."
He gave Clisson a challenging look.
"I thought you'd want to know."
It was out of the ordinary, like too many things tonight.
"'Have you heard anything from Dressel?'
"'No. I thought he was meant to report to you.'
"'He was,' said Clisson. He shook his head in frustration. "'So many signs, not enough evidence. Well, damn what the commander said. There was something going on.' He snapped his fingers at the underwatchman. "'You, find Watchman Tull in the barracks and tell him to double the guard on the prince. I don't care how it looks.' He snapped his fingers again at Hart. "'Check the dungeons and come straight back to me. I want to know why Captain Dressel hasn't sent word. I'm going to get the key to the vault. I want half a dozen men guarding the Ember Blade until it's safe in the prince's hands.'
"'Hail to the Emperor,'
said Hart, fist clenched, arm across his chest in salute. "'You might make Watchman first class yet,' said Clisson approvingly.
"'Master Ban! Master Ban! Open the door!'
The guards were hammering on the door now. It made no difference. There was no answer from inside.
"'Break it down,' Clisson told them,
but his guts were a ball of ice. "'He's choked on a bone and died. He's overdosed on feather milk. He's hanged himself for fear of the Iron Hand. Anything, anything but what Clisson suspected they'd find within. The guards barged and battered at the door until the lock gave way at last. They rushed in, swords drawn. Clisson came after. The room reeked of blood. Clisson took in the empty platter on the desk, the open window with the broken pane. Through the doorway he could see the Master of Keys' bloody carcass lying on the bed. He didn't need to enter the room to know the medallion had been taken from around his neck. "'This has gone too far,' he said to the guards, his voice flat. "'Come with me.'
"'Where are we going?'
"'The North Tower,' Clisson said. "'It's time to release the Dreadknights.' 99. Aaron and his companions approached the vault by a circuitous route, through empty halls and corridors rarely trodden. Using Yarin's keys, they had access to whole sections of Hammerholt, where the furniture was draped with cloth and their feet left prints in the dust. In this manner, they bypassed the celebrations entirely and reached the heights of the fortress without encountering another soul. The vault was in a squat square tower, far from the heart of the keep. They hurried up spiral stairs, following their map, and went through a door halfway up to find themselves in a short corridor, which soon turned a corner and led them to the vault at the end. Aaron had hoped to find it unguarded, but there was a single sentry on duty before the door, sitting on a stool, bored witless. His eyes widened in shock as he saw them, and he scrambled to his feet and drew his sword. Aaron took a breath to tell him to surrender, but Fenn shot him through the eye. "'He might have given up,' Aaron cried. "'He was in our way,' Fenn said coldly, "'and he was a Croden.' Aaron let the matter drop. Perhaps he was naive in wanting to keep the killing to a minimum when they were about such deadly business as revolution. But he didn't believe all Crodens were culpable for their master's crimes. That man's death felt needless.
"'Grubb wondered how he was going to get rid of that sentry,' said Grubb, melting out of the darkness behind them.
Cade jumped out of his skin.
"'God, but you nearly stopped my heart, you sneak!' he snapped. "'What's that stuck to your cheek? Is that roast beef? Have you been eating?'
For an answer, Grubb plucked the fleck of meat from his cheek, popped it in his mouth and smacked his lips. "'Do you have the key?' Orica asked him eagerly. Grubb held up a golden medallion on a chain. Said Cade, raising a finger.
"'This the key,' Grubb told them, before Cade could say what they were all thinking. "'Trust Grubb.'
"'Two words I never thought to hear together,' Cade said. He clapped his hands. "'Well then, who wants to see what's on the other side of that door?' The vault door was hard to recognize as a door at all. There was no handle to be seen. It was a slab of metal set into the wall between two pillars, 8 feet high and 5 broad. Etched into its surface was a dramatic angular bas-relief, showing the parable of Thomas and Toven and the Mad Ogryn.
Tovan was locked in combat with two hulking brutes, jaws agape in primitive faces, features stylized into geometric shapes in the Croden fashion. Thomas stood in the background, his hand raised, preaching aloud from a book. In the story, Thomas calmed the crazed Ogryn with the message of the Primus, and they went away meekly to spread the word among their people. Aaron thought that more than a little fanciful. The Ogryn were the hammer of the Ellaru, brutish shock troops, whose savage strength put even the Erds to shame. They weren't much given to religious introspection.
"Reckon I expected something bigger," Cade said, eyeing the door uncertainly.
The lantern light stirred shadows across the design, and the figures appeared to move.
"Big double doors, 20 feet high, that kind of thing."
Aaron stepped over the sentry's body.
"When you tell the tale, you can make it whatever size you like."
"Oh, no," said Cade. "I'll tell it like it is. Ain't no need to exaggerate this one."
He frowned.
"Hoi, there's a bit missing in the middle."
Aaron looked closer and saw a circular depression hidden among the Ogryn's limbs, with a multitude of tiny slots cut into it in a curious pattern.
"Grub," Aaron said, inviting him forward.
"You found the key. You should be the one to open it."
"There is blood on the medallion," Vika observed as Grub stepped up to the door. Grub snorted.
"Last owner didn't want to take it off," he said.
He fiddled with the medallion and separated it into two discs, one with a series of projecting teeth sticking out of the inner side. He held it up to show them.
"Key,"
he said, and placed it into the depression. The teeth fitted perfectly into the slots there. Grub turned it with his fingertips, and they heard the crunch of a lock disengaging from within. He turned and bowed with a flourish.
"Grub will accept congratulations and praise now," he informed them.
"How in Prynne's name did you work out that was the key to the vault?" Orica asked, amazed.
"Because Grub is a genius," he said matter-of-factly.
They hauled the sentry's body out of the way. Harrod pushed at the door, which did no good, then found that there were handholds cunningly crafted into the scene. He seized them and slowly pulled the door open. Aaron's fists clenched in anticipation, and he felt a wave of angry triumph. "You were wrong, Garrick. We did it. We're here." Ruck slid inside as soon as the gap was wide enough to admit her. The others followed more carefully, raising their lanterns to push back the darkness. Beyond the door was a circular chamber with pillared alcoves around the edge. Like the door that led to it, it was surprisingly small. Aaron had imagined a great treasure chamber. Instead, he found a neat, solid room of grey stone. In they went, searching the shadowed corners. Grub's eyes grew large and hungry as the lantern light fell on the prince's treasures, arranged among the alcoves. They saw a suit of exquisite witch-iron armour, polished to a mirror sheen, and a jewelled necklace in a glass display case. There was a copy of the Acts of Thomas and Tovan, bound with gold hinges, the sword and book symbol of the Sanctorum, crafted from silver and set with a blood-red ruby. They saw strange gifts from faraway lands, precious reliquaries and caskets, a gnoll skull set in amber, a long coat made of iridescent scales. Yet for all the treasures that surrounded him, Aaron's eyes were locked on only one. Set upon a pedestal, lying next to a scabbard on a cloth of blue silk, was the Ember Blade. His breath became short. For all the tales told of it, he'd thought it only a sword, a symbol they might use to unite his broken people. He hadn't expected it to have such presence, such magnetic power. The others watched as he approached it reverently, recognizing his right to take it. Even Grub seemed impressed enough that it temporarily overwhelmed his instinct to steal whatever he could get his hands on. Its hilt was a masterpiece of craftsmanship, forged from polished witch iron. Upon the pommel were inscribed words in Old Ossian, a tongue now lost to all but the scholars.
Black leather had been newly wrapped around the tang, and the quillons flowed like water to either side of the ricasso. But it was the blade that mesmerized Aaron, a length of pure embrium, the rarest metal known. It threw back the lantern light with a sullen red tint, like the glow of a dying fire, and the sight of it kindled a fire in his own breast. Everything had brought him to this. His father's death, the escape from the camp at Sulla's Bluff, the flight through Skavengard, and all that followed. He'd been forged, as surely as this blade had been forged, fashioned into a man capable of breaking into Hammerholt, of entering this vault, of seizing the sword. It was Garrick who'd planted the idea in his head, but Aaron who'd followed it through. The ember blade had called to him, and he'd come. His hand closed round the hilt, and he lifted it. It might have carried the weight of ages, but it was impossibly light. He understood now. The stories were true. He had no doubt that this sword, forged from the bones of Ossia, would inspire his countryfolk. Just to see it was to believe. He was so absorbed that at first he didn't notice the itch in his hand. Only when it became maddening did he tear his gaze away, and his joy turned to horror. A rash of blisters was spreading up his sword hand, swelling and bursting, oozing pus. His hand began to burn, and he cried out as the skin under the blisters split, and he saw something white and maggoty moving beneath. He staggered away from the pedestal, the ember blade still in his hand, but now a new pain was tormenting his scalp. He put his hand to it, felt something wet there, and a chunk of his hair sloughed free. The room was full of screams. He whirled and found the others clawing at themselves, pulling at their skin, eyes bulging with horror. There were no marks on them that he could see, yet they acted as if they were all touched by the same nightmarish affliction that was spreading throughout Aaron. He tried to speak, but his tongue had swollen, and his eyes were swimming with tears. Then he saw them, standing in the doorway, two figures he'd hoped never to see again. Clisson, bespectacled, quietly malevolent. Plague, wrapped in belts and straps with a black-spiked bow in his hand, his face a stitched mask of dead skin. Behind them stood a half-dozen iron guardsmen. The ember blade dropped from Aaron's hand, ringing loudly on the stone floor as he was seized by a cramp strong enough to bring him to his knees. They were all helpless. Even Ruck was writhing on the floor, biting at herself. This was the Dreadnought's work. It had to be. But the knowledge brought him no respite. "Aaron of Shoal Point," said Clisson. "Now, isn't this a surprise?" 100. The head butler had a ladle of soup to his lips, ready to judge its quality, when he saw the iron guardsman approaching through the chaos of the kitchens. He lowered the ladle and straightened his uniform as a frightened scrubber boy led the guardsman to him. "He asked for the man in charge," the boy mumbled, desperate to escape. The double-barred cross had a way of making even the innocent feel guilty.
"Thank you, Malik, you may go," said the butler.
Malik needed no second prompting. The guardsman was unusually unkempt for his rank. He was coarsely shaven and hollow-eyed, his lips chapped and red marks at the corners of his mouth. Momentary puzzlement creased the butler's face, but it wasn't his place to question.
"How may I help you, guardsman?"
"I have been sent by Overwatchman Clisson. The prince may be in danger, and I need your help."
His voice was a growl of command. The butler stiffened. "Of course," he said. "Anything."
"He is at the feast now?" the guardsman asked.
"We have just served the main course."
"How many swords at his side?"
"Only his bodyguards. No one else may carry a sword in his presence."
"Thank the Primus for that. Entrances and exits?"
"Two. The main door and a side entrance for servants."
"Are they stout?"
"Very."
The guardsman scanned the kitchen restlessly as he considered that information.
"And who holds keys to these doors?"
I do. And the Master of Keys, of course. The guardsman held out his hand.
Give them to me.
The butler hesitated, but only for a moment. He picked two keys off his ring and handed them over.
Delay the next course until I return, he said,
and then saluted briskly.
Hail to the Emperor.
Hail to the Emperor, the butler replied, making a salute of his own, but the guardsman was already on his way. Crodens, Garrick thought, scornfully, as he strode through the clattering, steaming kitchen. His untidy appearance, his inauthentic accent, his unusual request, all these should have raised suspicion. But they were conditioned to obey authority without question, and so long as he was dressed as an iron guardsman, they'd do as he said. Whatever failings the Ossians had, they didn't share that one. When nobody was looking, he snatched up a knife and slipped it beneath his steel armguard. When it came to murder, the fast blade trumped the sword. He made his way upstairs quickly. Time was against him, and when his escape was discovered, Clisson really would send reinforcements. Perhaps he already had, since he'd been suspicious enough to send Captain Dressel to the dungeons. But Hammerholt was vast, and orders took time to travel, and the butler had only mentioned the bodyguard. If reinforcements were coming at all, Garrick had to hope he'd get to the hall before they did. Ifs and buts and maybes. It didn't matter. 100 swords or one, his course was set. He'd die today. The only question was how many he could take with him. Following the map in his mind, he found the main door to the feast hall. The sounds of conversation and clinking glasses came from within, the restrained formal revels of Croden High Society. Garrick locked the door from outside, then went up a side passage to the servants' entrance. He grasped the handle, closed his eyes, and took a breath. Now to death, and darkness, and glory. He opened the door and stepped through. The feast hall was long and high-ceilinged, with lamps burning on the walls and glowing wrought-iron braziers standing in the corners, radiating heat and light. The walls were draped with thick tapestries depicting hunting scenes. At one end stood the main doors, while at the other a few steps led up to a raised dais separated off from the festivities with green velvet curtains. Garrick, unnoticed at the edge of the feast, closed the door behind him and surreptitiously locked it. Tables ran the length of the hall, arranged in a hollow rectangle. Diners laughed and gossiped, drank from glittering crystal glasses, cut meat with shiny silver knives. The light of a candelabrum reflected in a lady's eyes as she gazed with veiled lust upon her neighbour. A red-faced Croden guffawed, drunk on wine and company. A nervous young man pulled at his food, waiting for an opportunity to join the conversation surrounding him. The air smelled of roast venison, buttered leeks, hot coals and perfume. All this Garrick noticed, and more besides. He wasn't observant by nature, but he drank in every detail now. His senses had opened up, absorbing as much of the world as they could before the end. This was the last room he'd ever see, these the last faces. He was alive now as he'd never been before. The servant's door was near the head of the room, where Prince Otico sat with his back to the curtains. Garrick briefly wondered what was behind them. Spare chairs, rolled-up tapestries, a grand dessert ready to be unveiled with a flourish. But once he found his target, the thought went out of his head. Prince Otico was disappointingly mundane in the flesh. For all his power, for all that he represented to the people of Croda, he was just a man, and an unimpressive one at that. He was pale and soft, barely able to grow a moustache despite being in his 30s. The bodyguard was the threat here, tall, shovel-nosed and keen of eye. He stood a short distance behind the prince, his hand resting on his sword. He was the one Garrick would have to reckon with first. Further along the table he saw the hated General Dakan, his white hair cut short, looking robust and vigorous despite his 70 years. Dakan would be third to die. He owed his fellow Dawnwardens that. But it was all for nothing if Prince Otico lived.
The prince was the priority. Garrick strode around the edge of the room with the purposeful air of a man who was meant to be there. A few diners spotted him, but they thought him a messenger and saw no threat. Dakin was one of the few who would recognize him, armor or no, but he was deep in conversation. The bodyguard was more alert, and he moved to meet Garrick, positioning himself in front of the prince. Garrick saw the flicker in his eyes as he noted the sword at Garrick's hip and the disheveled look of him. This wasn't a man to be cowed by a uniform. Garrick stopped before him and saluted smartly, fist clenched, arm across his chest.
"Hail to the Emperor," he said in greeting. "Hail to the Emperor," said the bodyguard, and saluted automatically.
The instant his sword hand moved away from the hilt, Garrick pulled his knife from inside his arm guard and buried it in the bodyguard's throat. The bodyguard gargled, clawing at his neck, eyes turned up to the ceiling. Blood fountained from the wound, spattering the food and faces of the prince and his neighbours. Garrick pushed him aside, toppling him to the floor in a clatter of armour, and drew his sword. Now he was surrounded by screams as people scrambled to flee. Hot blood pulsed at his temples as he bore down on his target. Prince Otico had the terrified glaze of a child seeing a bogeyman in the flesh.
"I am the Hollow Man, and I've come for you."
Garrick reached the prince, but Otico went boneless and slid off his chair and under the table like an eel. It was such an unmanly act of cowardice that it took Garrick completely by surprise. Garrick lunged for him, but the prince was already crawling away, scrambling between the feet of the panicked diners. Garrick tried to grab him, but guests and fallen chairs got in his way. Finally, he shoved a shrieking lady aside and vaulted over the table, scattering plates and candelabra. There were no chairs on the other side to hinder him, and he caught the wriggling prince by the boot and pulled him out from beneath the table. Some of the guests were pounding on the doors or screaming, while others watched in horror as Garrick raised his sword to kill the prince. A battle cry sounded to his left, and he heard running feet. The blade that was meant for the prince's skull turned to meet the attack instead, clanging against the sword that swung down towards him. It was General Dakin, wielding the bodyguard's weapon which Garrick had failed to take. He cursed himself for the oversight.
"Dog, you will not murder an unarmed man," Dakin spat.
Seeing his chance, the prince kicked wildly, catching Garrick in the thigh. In the same moment, Dakin attacked, and Garrick lost his grip on the prince as he was forced to defend himself. Otico scrabbled under the table again, and was hauled out on the other side by a few guests who hadn't tried to flee. Garrick turned a dark gaze onto Dakin. He'd been a heartbeat from killing Otico, and the prince had escaped. But it would only be a temporary stay of execution.
"You were next anyway," he snarled.
"I think not," said the general, circling around, poised in the stance of a trained fighter. 30 years I've been waiting to finish the job I started." His blade flicked out. Garrick knocked it away and retaliated, testing his enemy's guard, finding it solid. Bad to worse, he didn't have time for a drawn-out fight. Already the doors were being battered from the other side as servants and guards tried to get in. They'd break in the end, or a key would be found. He glanced at the prince, but he was hiding behind his nobles. Garrick would never reach him before Dakin cut him down.
"Let's make this quick, then."
They prowled around each other, searching for an opening. The tables had become the limits of their private arena. Age hadn't slowed the general, but Garrick, who wasn't much younger, twinged with pain from a dozen injuries sustained on the torture table. His skin pulled over new scars, his bruises hampered him, and his ruined gums had begun to bleed again. The unfamiliar weight of the armour was sapping his strength, and he'd already been weakened by the Iron Hand's ministrations. He blocked out the pain as best he could, and remembered that night when his best friend had slit his throat, and he'd crawled into the forest to die with the sound of slaughter in his ears.
"You didn't destroy the Dawn Warden's Dakin," he growled. "Eckard the Quick did that.
You were just a lowly captain in the right place at the right time who forged his career from that happy chance. Must have pained your betters to see you climb so high without merit.
He moved fast, bringing a flurry of blows down on his opponent. Dakin, wearing no armor, was faster still. He knocked them away one by one and made no attempt to return them, keeping his distance instead.
He's playing for time, Garrick thought in frustration, waiting for reinforcements, wearing me down.
Some might say that being in the right place at the right time is the very essence of war, Dakin said. And here I am again.
A lunge, a parry. The doors thundered under renewed assault from the other side. Garrick caught another glimpse of the prince, shielded by his barons and dukes. So close, and yet Garrick couldn't get to him. It made him want to howl with fury.
"Nothing to say?" Dakin taunted. "Then let me tell you how my career will end, which you think so free of merit. After I have killed you, I will retire in glory to the motherland and be remembered forever as a hero of the Empire. You, on the other hand, will not even have the honour of an Ossian burial. We will burn you on a pyre the Croden way, and you will be cleansed with the light of the Primus."
Garrick gave him a bloody grin.
"See, there's the difference between us, Dakin," he said. "You're planning to have a long and happy life, but I came here to die."
He threw himself forward, swinging wildly with no thought for defence. Dakin was taken off guard by the suicidal force of it. He barely parried the first blow and only just managed to turn the second aside. As Garrick brought his blade around again, Dakin swung frantically into the gap. Garrick threw up his left arm and cried out as the blade smashed into his armour with enough force to break the bone beneath. His own blade took Dakin horizontally in the side of the head, smashing through cheek and teeth and skull before coming to a jarring halt in the centre of his face. Horrified screams filled the room. With an animal bellow of rage, Garrick tore his sword free from the mangled ruin of the general's head. His body spun away and crashed to the floor, oozing brain and blood onto the flagstones. Garrick turned, panting, his face spattered red and one arm hanging limp. There was a mad hatred in his gaze, the savage anger of a dying animal. He pointed his sword at Prince Otico. "Now you," he said. The door to the hall exploded inwards in a shower of splinters and spinning wood. Garrick staggered away, his sword arm up before his face. When he lowered it again, he felt the cold touch of despair on his heart. Stooping through the doorway was a mountain of a man, clad in tarnished black armour, an enormous warhammer held in both hands. Ruin had come.
101.
Vika clawed at the stone floor of the vault, crawling horrors on her tongue, skin itching with burrowing worms. Around her, the others retched and pawed at themselves, helpless before plague. He stepped into the room, making a soft, wet clicking sound, like bones rattling in his throat. Clisson followed with his troops, but they were insignificant ghosts to Vika's eyes. She didn't see them as the others did. The foul shock of the Dread Knight's power had triggered a reaction in her mind. Beneath the skin of reality, something swarmed, and chaos bled through the weave of the world as the Shadowlands pressed close. Her battle with the Beast of Skavengard, and the days she spent fighting off plague's corrupting poison, had taught her things that Agali never could. She'd been changed by the touch of the Abyss, and hadn't known it till now. For the first time, Vika touched the Shadowlands without need of a potion to help her. Her senses teetered, and madness loomed. She had to fight the demon. He was a blasphemy to the Aspects, and she was compelled to destroy him. But though her instincts demanded it, her body refused to comply. Her skin split and festered, and her mind was a wild whirl of panic.
"You should have run and kept running,"
Clisson was talking to Aaron, who was writhing at his feet.
"You might even have got away. But to come back? What were you thinking?"
The light.
Where was the sacred light that shone from her at the gates of Skavengard, which had driven the Dread Knights back? How had she done that? She fought to remember, but her fingernails were splitting and flaking away, and she was choking on a throat filled with maggots. "I will torture Cade to death," Clisson said, "and you will watch. It will bring me no pleasure, but I must keep my word. The Iron Hand are the conscience of the Empire, and you must admit, you were warned."
"Aspects, save us," Vika begged, but the aspects were silent.
She moaned in desperate frustration. Why set her on this path if they refused to help in her time of direst need? Why show her the end of the world if they wouldn't help her avert it? Doubt swarmed in. Agali always said she doubted too readily. But the aspects had shown her a champion wielding a blade that shone like the sun, and he'd abandoned them. What was she to think then? She'd let herself be guided by visions, but the mad saw visions as clear as the holy. Visions! The thought gave her an instant of clarity through the fog of nightmare. Her companions were racked with pain as she was, but she saw no sign of affliction upon them. The worms and boils and blackening flesh were visions put in their minds by plague's dark power. They were only as real as she believed them to be.
"Then I don't believe."
She knew this demon. She'd cured herself of his poison, and she'd learned him. He'd tried to kill her once and failed, and she was stronger for it.
"This isn't real."
The pain began to draw back, only a little, for she couldn't entirely quiet the shrieking in her mind. But she doubted these terrors now, and her doubt weakened them. "Shackle the prisoners," Clisson was saying, dimly heard at the edge of her consciousness. "We'll take them for questioning. Between them, they will give us the rest of the rebels in Morgenholm."
"What about the dog?" one of the guardsmen said.
Clisson sniffed.
"Kill it."
"No!"
Panic shot through her like a bolt. She raised her head, fighting to clear her mind. The others thrashed on the floor of the vault, backs arching and eyes rolling, howling at their private torture as the guards began to spread out between them. One was making his way towards Ruck, sword drawn. Plague stood at the edge of the room, his dead skin mask impassive.
"Get up! Fight him!"
she told herself, but it was beyond her. She wasn't strong enough to face down that thing alone. She needed the aspects with her, and the aspects wouldn't come.
"Why aren't you here with me now? Why?"
A memory came to her then, clear and vivid, a pool of calm in the chaos. She stood in the light of a fire, staring into a stream that ran through a forest clearing and past her feet. Agali Sings the Dark was standing behind her.
5 times I was visited by the gods," Vika had said. 5 times, and then no more. Can you imagine that? To be so blessed, and then not to be."
"I have never seen them," said Agali, "only their signs and agents. Be grateful for what grace was given you. We are each tested in our own way."
She heard the rank ingratitude in her words, to complain that she'd only been visited 5 times by the aspects when Agali kept Iron Faith on much slimmer evidence.
"We are each tested in our own way."
"If the aspects are silent," Agali had said, "it is because we have forgotten how to listen."
The soldier walked closer to Ruck, his step heavy with doom, blade ready in his hand. Ruck gnawed her own foreleg and whined, oblivious to her impending death. Vika's staff lay next to her. She reached for it, but was hit by a fresh spasm which collapsed her again. Tears sprang to her eyes as she lay, cheek to the ground, looking at her beloved hound. So close, and yet she couldn't save her. She couldn't rise up and fight.
"Not real. It's not real."
But if she felt it so keenly, did it even matter whether it was real or not? A glint of red caught her eye, like the bloody light of a new dawn. The ember blade, which had fallen from Aaron's hand. The standard of their nation. Another memory hit her, from moments before, Aaron lifting the ember blade, holding it aloft, the triumph and joy on his face. Her eyes widened.
The champion with the bright blade.
Her vision had been clear all along. It was just that she failed to understand it. She'd been so certain Garrick was the champion that she'd forced all the evidence to fit that theory and then blamed the aspects when he'd disappointed her. But it was her mistake. They hadn't shown her Garrick. They'd shown her Aaron.
If the aspects are silent, it is because we have forgotten how to listen.
The revelation tumbled through her like an avalanche. She'd thought she was listening, but she hadn't been. Instead, she'd fashioned herself a champion and appointed herself his protector. Vika, chosen of the gods, tasked with the sacred duty to save the world. She'd made herself special, as she'd been when she was a young girl, as she'd wanted to be ever since the aspects stopped visiting her. And all along, she'd demanded clearer signs, more help, intervention from the Nine.
We are each tested in our own way.
She'd been arrogant, and now she recognized that. She remembered how she'd felt at Skavengard when she'd driven the Dreadknights back. She hadn't defeated them through any power of her own. Instead, she'd let herself be used, becoming a channel for the Aspect's will. All she needed to do was to submit.
I am your instrument, she thought. Use me as you see fit.
And with that, she found the light. She felt it first in her breast, a blazing star of wrath bursting into existence. It blasted away the corruption that clung to her mind and body, driving out the foulness. A tide of strength crashed through her. She snatched up her staff, planted it in the ground and rose to one knee.
Back!
She cried, throwing out a hand towards the soldier standing over Ruck, ready to impale her.
You will not touch her!
The guardsman faltered, halted by the power in her voice. The prisoners were meant to be incapacitated. He looked at Clisson uncertainly, who looked to Plague in turn. The Dreadknight stepped forwards, gaze fixed on her, and the clicking in his throat became louder. Vika felt his terrible will bear down on her again, but the light was growing in her now, and nothing could hold it back. The air seethed and swam as the chaotic stuff of the Shadowlands pressed close. Angles stretched impossibly. Faces shifted as if viewed through water. Lanterns flickered, waned, and grew fierce again.
You are a creature of the Abyss, she accused,
and she pulled herself to her feet, dragging herself up the length of her staff.
You are unhallowed, and your Crodan masters are damned for treating with you. Spawn of the Outsiders, these are Joha's lands, and the Nine rule here.
The light flared in her, filling her up, and it was impossible to contain it any longer. She lifted her staff in the air.
Down, beast, she cried,
and it shone with a blinding glow. Plague cringed from the light, throwing a hand up to shadow his stitch-riven face.
Down!
She shouted again, and thrust the staff towards him. Plague staggered back, rattling like an angry snake.
Kill her!
Clisson shouted at the soldiers. At his order, the guardsmen overcame their uncertainty and advanced on Vika. Either they didn't see the light or were not affected by it. Vika was so focused on Plague that she didn't notice them coming. The nearest guard, who'd been about to kill Ruck, drew back his sword to stab her in the ribs. A snarling mass of teeth and fur knocked him to the ground before the blade could find its mark. Suddenly the vault was alive with confusion and movement as the fallen companions, freed from Plague's influence, surged to their feet and took up their weapons. Harrod's sword was first to his hand. He clashed with two men, then three, holding them off until Aaron could bring his own blade to the fight. Grubb leapt onto a soldier and tore away a piece of his chin with his teeth, then knifed him as he screamed. Vika was only half aware of it, locked in her own battle. The light was too fierce to bear, burning her from the inside out. She couldn't sustain it for much longer. Plague cowered before her upraised staff, but she could only repel him, not destroy him, and when her strength failed, he'd kill her. She began to claw inside her patchwork cloak, her fingers brushing over the clay files there. "Kill that Ossian witch!" Clisson demanded again, but in all the disorder he went unheard. Seeing that nobody would do it for him, he drew his own knife and circled around Plague. Vika was still fixated on the Dreadknight, unarmed but for her staff, and his hands flexed on the hilt of his knife as he prepared to stab her. He was an instant too slow. Vika found the file she needed and drew it out. "Down!" she screamed again, and she flung it into the Dreadknight's face. It shattered as it hit, covering his head and upper body with a viscous jelly which burst into flame the moment it was released. Clisson was caught at the edge of the splash, his arm and face spattered with blobs of the stuff. He wailed in pain and horror as it ignited, dropping his knife and flailing backwards, beating senselessly at his own face and arms. Plague went up like dry tinder. He reeled away with a frenzied clattering coming from his mouth. Black smoke boiled off him, and the air filled with the choking stench of burning flesh and something foul and bitter underneath. Then she could hold the light no longer, and somehow, she knew not how, she shut it off. The strength flowed out of her like water, and she sagged, but she was caught by Cade before she could fall, and he dragged her upright again. "Come on!" he cried, as he led her round the edge of the room, stepping over bodies, hurrying past treasures of uncountable value. To their left, Harrod and Aaron fought with several guardsmen, their backs to the door, keeping the soldiers occupied in the centre of the chamber while their companions made their escape. Clisson was on his knees in an alcove, his back to them, hands beating frantically at his face. "The Ember Blade?" Vika gasped. "Orica has it," said Cade. Plague's thin, ragged body had become a torch. He staggered across the chamber and fell against the guardsmen's backs, sending them into agonized panic as they were burned from behind. While they were distracted, Aaron and Harrod slipped out behind Vika and Cade. In the corridor were Ruck, Grubb, and Orica, who had the ember blade in one hand and its scabbard in the other. Fenn fired her last arrow through the doorway, killing a guardsman who tried to follow them out. Grubb put his shoulder to the vault door and shoved. As the door swung closed, Vika caught a glimpse of a frightened face, lit by the burning, slumped heap that Plague had become. It was Clisson, his spectacles gone and his eyes full of fear. One gloved hand held his cheek as he stumbled towards them, the other reaching out in supplication.
"Don't close the door! Don't close the—"
The vault boomed shut. Grubb twisted the Master of Keys medallion to lock it, then spat on the door.
"Grubb liked to see you get out of that any time soon," he sneered.
They slumped against the walls, panting, drained by the horrors they'd endured. There was no triumph, just the shock of survival. A great weakness lay on Vika, bone deep, so heavy she could hardly stand. Ruck flurried around her, licking at her fingers, and she could have wept with relief at the touch of that slobbering tongue. From behind the door, they heard the faint thumping of Clisson's fists, his howls as he begged for escape. It was Aaron who spoke first.
"We make for the Underkeep," he said. "It's our only way out."
Orica offered him the ember blade and its scabbard. He took the sword and sheathed it. A faint and weary smile touched Vika's lips as she looked at him.
"Lead on," she said.
102. Ruin's hammer swung high and hard, smashing apart the table in front of him. Nearby guests huddled and shrieked as they were pelted with splinters, glasses, food and wine. The Dreadknight heaved the sundered table aside and stepped past, into the makeshift arena where Garrick stood with one arm hanging limp, the body of General Dakin at his feet. Soldiers hurried into the feasting hall behind him. Some ran to surround the prince, others spread out around the room. Seeing their chance, many of the guests fled through the broken door, but some, mostly Croden, stayed. They were reluctant to abandon their prince,
or they didn't want to be branded disloyal. That, or they just wanted to see what would happen next. Garrick backed away from the monstrous figure, his legs trembling with weakness. Torture had sapped his strength, and fighting Dakin had tired him. But the final blow was despair. The prince was beyond his reach now. Even if he could beat this dark giant, there was a forest of blades between them. He hefted his sword, which was now so heavy he could hardly lift it. Men with crossbows were moving into place for a shot, and the prince was being hustled away. 30 years a rebel, and he may as well have been a flea for all the trouble he'd caused the empire. 30 years of failing. They spoke true who said that one man couldn't make a difference against such might. He'd been arrogant to dream he could. Let them kill me, then, he thought, as he saw the crossbowmen set their sights. But there will be no surrender.
Stop!
Cried Prince Otico. His voice brought the soldiers to a halt, and the Dreadknight, too. All eyes went to the prince, who was irritably shrugging off one of his barons.
Unhand me! He snapped.
His gaze met Garrick's across the room, over the shoulders of his guards, and there was a glitter of hungry malice there. He'd been scared and humiliated, but the tables had turned now, and he wanted vengeance.
This man, this assassin, was once counted among the greatest of Ossian warriors, he declared red-faced. Let us see how he fares against a Crodan warrior, then. Crossbowmen, stay your triggers. Let the Dread Knight have him.
Your Highness, let us take you to safety, the Baron beseeched, but Prince Otico waved him away.
There are a dozen men between us. I will stay to see the last Dawn Warden fall. Ruin stepped closer, his hammer ready. Garrick kept out of his reach. For all his courage in battle, he knew fear now. It radiated from his opponent, setting his skin crawling. If any heart beat beneath that armour, it belonged to no ordinary man.
"Death to the enemies of the Empire!"
cried some enthusiastic patriot in the audience, and Ruin lunged forward. Garrick was ready for the attack, and jumped out of the way as the hammer came down, shattering the flagstones. He hacked at his enemy's outstretched hand, but he was off balance, and his blow rebounded from the armour. The agony of sudden movement almost made him faint, as the two halves of his broken bone ground against each other. He staggered away, retching up bile. There were cheers from the audience and shouts of abuse.
"Elitist scum! Die, traitor!
The Nemesis welcomes you!" Garrick barely heard them through the red mist of pain. His vision had narrowed to a tunnel, at the end of which he saw Ruin advancing again, hammer cradled in his massive hands. Instinct told him to attack, but he held himself in check.
Wait for it. Wait.
The hammer came from the side. Ruin was quicker than his size suggested. Garrick dropped to one knee and ducked as it whistled over his head. Then he thrust forward, aiming for a chink in the Dreadknight's armour. But Ruin shifted his weight, and the gap closed before he could reach it. For all its brutish design, the armour was a masterpiece, an impenetrable carapace of witch iron. The next swing came from overhead, so fast that Garrick barely dodged it. He sprang up and back as the floor exploded in a stinging flurry of stone chips. Unbalanced by his dead arm, he tripped over his heels, stumbling backwards till he crashed into the edge of a table. Plates smashed, spraying food. Cutlery bounced away across the floor. Someone reached over the table and shoved him from behind, sending him reeling back towards Ruin. He saw the hammer coming to meet him and dug in his heels, his sword raised automatically in defence. The hammer blasted past his face, missing his nose by inches. It caught the blade instead, ripping it from his grasp and sending it spinning away. It slid under a table and was snatched up by a Crodan who raised it in the air to the cheers of the audience.
"How unfortunate," sneered the prince. "It seems you've lost your blade."
Ruin lumbered towards him. Garrick, dizzy and weaponless, tried to back away, but there was no strength left in his legs. He was helpless as he was seized by the throat and lifted off the ground. The Dread Knight's armoured hand was cold enough to burn, and its touch carried a creeping foulness that horrified him. Garrick kicked uselessly at the air, choking. His ears roared with blood and the triumphant cries of the audience. The world tipped and spun as he was thrown bodily across the room. He smashed down onto a table, skidded across it in an avalanche of goblets and furrowed cloth, and flew off the other side to crash into a brazier. Hot coals scattered as it tipped over. He lay there gasping in agony, his broken arm screaming at him. He'd snapped at least two ribs in the impact, and they sawed at his back with every drawn breath. He was bruised and torn, and there was blood in his mouth. He was dying, of that he was certain. But still he clawed at the ground, dragging his knees beneath him. Still he fought to stand. "Fetch water! Water!" he heard somebody cry. Fire was blooming at the edge of his vision, a tapestry ignited by the coals. "My prince, we must leave," the baron pleaded. "Nobody leaves until justice is done," Prince Otico yelled in fury. Ruin filled Garrick's vision, a faceless monster of dirty iron. He tried feebly to fend him off, but he was seized by the throat again and lifted up. "End it," he begged silently, because he wouldn't beg aloud. "End me." There was no such mercy. He was thrown high and far, flailing through the air towards the curtained alcove at the far end of the room. Plush fabric swallowed him. There was a moment of excruciating impact as he crashed into something unforgivingly hard. Blackness took him, but all too briefly. When he opened his eyes, he was tangled in a green velvet curtain which had fallen across his face. It was sodden, and there was an acrid stink coming from it. His head pounded, and there was a ferocious knot of agony at the base of his skull. Below that, he felt nothing at all. A deep calm came over him. He was disembodied, helpless in an ocean of fabric. That last collision had broken his neck. "No more then," he thought, his mind clear and serene. "I strived and failed, but none can say I did not give my all." Footsteps, slow and heavy, coming closer. The curtain was pulled from his face, and ruin stood over him. Behind him, Garrick could see the hall, where soldiers were beating at the fire that had spread to a nearby tablecloth. His eyes were dimmed and everything was blurring. It all seemed like a strange play, viewed as from some far distance. There was the prince, surrounded by nobles, imploring him to retreat from the smoke and growing flames. There was General Dakin, sprawled out on the flagstones in a pool of gore. And there was a little girl, too, a little girl wearing a black hooded robe, her forehead high and white. He couldn't focus well enough to see her clearly, but he knew she was watching him, standing eerily still at the edge of the room, while others flurried around her. His eyes rolled in their orbits. They were the only thing he could move now. He lay among the shattered remains of a barrel rack, which had been hidden behind the curtain, where the servants could draw drinks for the guests. His body was twisted and limp, tangled in bloody armour and splintered shards of wood, and his face was wet with spilled wine. Wine and something else that gave off a sharp reek, which he recognised. "Stop playing and finish him," the prince ordered. Ruin lifted his hammer, ready to bring it down on Garrick's skull. But Garrick wasn't looking at him. He'd caught sight of a broken crest amid the folds of curtain. Two wolves rampant, flanking a spreading tree, the emblem of the Amberline Vineyards. "The prince will have no sweet wine but Amberline with his dessert.
It's one of the few things he likes about our country. He knew that smell. He'd smelled it in Mara's barn as he filled these very barrels with Ellerite oil. His gaze flicked from the crest to the burning tablecloth and the thick, clear liquid spilling down the stairs towards it. Finally, he looked up at his enemy, into the darkness behind his visor. A smile of triumph spread across his bruised and discoloured face.
"For Ossia," he croaked hoarsely.
Then all was fire and force, and nothing after. 103. They hurried by lantern-light down silent ways, faces grim with the memory of what had gone before and the thought of what lay ahead. Aaron would never forget the sight of his skin bursting with boils, nor the taste of diseased flesh in his mouth, but it was already losing the power to terrify him, fading like a nightmare. Plague's touch had humbled them all, and Aaron was ashamed at how completely he'd succumbed to it. But they'd defeated him nonetheless, thanks to their druidess. He looked back over his shoulder. Vika was catching them up, staff in hand, Ruck trotting protectively at her side. She'd plainly been exhausted by fighting Plague, but after swigging a concoction from one of her phials, she'd found strength to move again. What secret battle had she fought with the Dreadknight while he was occupied with his own agonies? Had there been a light, or had he imagined that? All he knew was that Vika alone had overcome Plague, driven him cowering before her and set him aflame. She'd proved stronger than the foul sorcery of their enemy. It was enough to make Aaron wonder if the aspects were real after all, and on their side. Anything felt possible with the ember blade in his hands. He clutched it close to his chest as he hustled through dusty rooms, passing covered furniture and walls empty of tapestries or decoration. The sword was sheathed now, but its nearness heartened him and made him brave. Their route took them back to the lower levels by the same way they'd come. With luck, Mara had anticipated their decision and would meet them at the entrance to the Underkeep. If not, she'd head there when the alarm was raised, which couldn't be long now. Once in the Underkeep, there was no telling what they might find, but whatever it was, Aaron had faith that he and his companions could handle it. They'd claimed the Ember Blade. There was nothing they couldn't do. They came to a shadowy hall, huge and echoing, grey in the moonlight. Aaron went first, and the others came behind him. Grubb, his eyes glittering with dark excitement. Orica, fearful, watching for enemies. Harrod, stoic as ever, with Vika labouring at his side and Ruck loping at hers. Fenn's expression was cold, yet even so, Aaron found it hard to take his gaze from her face. Last was Cade, holding the lantern, his jaw set. They were strung out in a line, halfway across the hall, when a deafening boom of thunder sounded from the heart of the keep, and Hammerholt shuddered. The floor shook beneath them, and they staggered this way and that. Chunks of masonry plunged from the ceiling, smashing around them and driving them to the walls, which seemed less dangerous than open space. But the walls were shivering too. Great cracks appeared in the masonry, jerking and branching like black lightning. At last, the sound faded, leaving the hall quiet but for their terrified breathing and Ruck's wild barks as she spun in circles, snapping at phantoms. A haze of dust hung around them, and a long, ominous groan sounded from overhead. They looked to the ceiling, newly conscious of the immense tonnage of stone above them. In the distance they heard faint screams.
"He did it," Aaron whispered, half in horror and half in awe. "Shades! He did it!"
Far above, a rumble of stone and a dull crash sent a tremble through the hall. It shook harder as another crash came, closer now, then another, loud as the end of the world.
"Run!"
Fenn screamed, and they fled for the exit. Aaron tripped and sprawled as the ceiling burst, spewing a torrent of rock and dust, which smashed through the floor behind him.
The ember blade jolted free from his grip as he fell. He reached to snatch it back, but a stone smacked off his arm and he withdrew it quickly, folding it over his head in a futile attempt to protect himself from falling masonry. Something punched his thigh with numbing force, making him jerk and curl up. The noise was overwhelming, drowning his senses in a blare. He could do nothing but cower and wait for his fate to find him. The tumult died as rapidly as it had come, leaving a loud ringing in his ears. He raised his head and blinked dust from his eyes. The rocks had stopped falling, and somehow he was still alive. The hall had become a netherworld of drifting grey, where lumps of shadow loomed at the limit of his vision. He heard a sob from Orica and tried to find her. One of the lumps, which he'd thought was a fallen rock, unfolded and separated. It was Harrod and Orica together. The knight had thrown himself across her.
"Are you hurt?" Aaron called.
"Grab is here. Grab is all right," came the Skald's voice from somewhere.
"She is not hurt," said Harrod. Aaron pulled himself upright, wincing as his leg protested. He tested his weight on it, but it was only bruised and not broken. A trickle of blood ran down his temple from his hairline. He couldn't feel the cut. Still dazed, he looked around with a growing sense of alarm. Orica, Harrod and Grubb were all accounted for. He heard Ruck barking and saw Vika moving nearby, a shambling silhouette amid the destruction. But he'd lost sight of the ember blade in the murk. And where were Cade and Fenn?
"Aaron!"
It was Fenn's voice, filled with such fright it made his blood freeze.
"Aaron, where are you? I found Cade!"
"Aaron!"
Cade's terrified cry set him running, all thoughts of the ember blade forgotten. The far end of the hall had completely disappeared, leaving only a ruined hole above and below. He could see its near edge, dimly, ragged and torn, with broken timber beams thrusting out.
"Where are you?" he cried.
"Aaron!"
Cade wailed again.
"Oh, shades! Aaron!"
"Over here!" Fenn called. Aaron saw her now, crouched near the edge of the hole. He ran to her. Green eyes stared from a face caked with grey dust. She pointed at the swirling haze above the hole. Aaron tried desperately to find Cade, but to no avail.
"Out on the beam,"
she said, her voice tight. Aaron's stomach upended. Cade was sprawled awkwardly across the end of a splintered beam that projected horizontally over an unknown drop. His arms were flung across it, fingers locked to the far edge, legs dangling.
"Oh, nine! Oh, nine!"
he was whimpering.
"I can't go out there," said Fenn helplessly. "I can't. I'll fall."
Aaron ran to the beam. It was perhaps 2 feet wide, with a jagged split where it emerged from the stone. Cade was a dozen feet away, his upper body spread across the beam, legs hanging in space.
"I can't hold on,"
he cried.
"Can you move along the beam?"
Aaron called.
"I'm stuck. I can't hold on."
He was panicking. Aaron tried to keep his own panic in check.
"I'm coming to get you. Hurry!"
Aaron lowered himself onto the beam with clumsy haste. The murk was thinning a little now, enough to see the far end of the hole. The wall of the hall had been destroyed, and the rooms beyond exposed. Below him, he saw the orange glow of fire blooming through the dust. Cade's lantern must have smashed and ignited something down there. Over the ringing in his ears, he could hear distant screams drifting through the fortress. There was a dull rumble as another section collapsed, and he held tight to the stone at his back as Hammerholt shivered in response. Orica, Harrod and Vika arrived, with Ruck at their heels, drawn by Fenn's cries. He heard them frantically discussing ways to rescue Cade, but Aaron couldn't wait for them. He dropped to his hands and knees and crawled out along the beam. A low, sinister creak sounded beneath him, followed by the stealthy sound of wood peeling apart. He froze.
"The beam is too weak, Aaron," said Vika.
Her voice was grave and flat. Aaron sucked in a breath, bit his lip,
and inched forward again, with his eyes on Cade. A loud crack beneath him made him start, and the beam tilted fractionally downwards.
"Stop! Stop! You'll break it!" Cade pleaded.
Aaron could see his face now, powdered with grime, his eyes wide and glistening with terror.
"We're making a rope,"
Orica called. Harrod was pulling off his jacket, Vika her cloak, but it was a hopeless effort, driven by the need to do something. All their clothes together wouldn't make a rope long and strong enough to save him, and the moment Cade let go to take it, he'd fall. The only chance was to get to him. Aaron moved forward again. The beam creaked and sagged.
"Stop!"
Cade begged.
"I'm coming,"
Aaron said relentlessly.
"Hold on!" "You'll kill us both, you mudwit!"
Cade screamed. The hysteria in his voice halted Aaron. Cade had never screamed at him like that before. Tears of frustration welled in his eyes. He could almost reach out and touch his friend. Going back now was impossible. Just a little further. The beam would hold. It would.
"I have to try," he said.
"No," Cade said. His eyes became clear. Terror replaced by firm purpose. A decision had been made.
"You don't. No sense both of us dying today." "I told you,"
Aaron said, his voice thick with tears.
"I'll never leave you behind."
Cade gave him a sad smile.
"You ain't,"
he said softly.
"You ain't, Aaron. I'm leaving you."
He loosed his grip and fell. Aaron screamed and lunged forward to catch him, but he was too late. Cade plummeted like a stone, the dust and smoke swirling around him as he dropped out of sight.
"Cade! Cade!"
Aaron shouted into the gloom. He was laid out flat on the beam, reaching down as if he could stretch far enough to bring his friend back. The world rushed in on him like a torrent. His senses roared with shock. Cade was gone. It wasn't true. It couldn't be. Dimly, he realized the others were shouting at him. He felt the beam shift beneath him and heard a long, tortured creak. Suddenly focused, he scrambled backwards along the beam, but his dive to save Cade had taxed it too far. It jerked and tipped forward as it broke away from the stone. He shrieked in fear as the beam slid out from under him, and he fell head first and flailing into the same abyss as Cade. A hand closed round his ankle, arresting his fall with a jolt. Looking up, he saw Harrod there, holding fast to him. Fenn seized his other foot, and grunting and groaning they hauled him up. When he was near enough, Orica and Vika took hold too, and between them they pulled him to safety. No sooner did he have the ground under his feet than he was up again, staring over the edge, yelling Cade's name.
"We have to go down there,"
he insisted, tears cutting paths through the dust on his cheeks.
"He might still be alive. We have to look."
But he knew by their expressions that they couldn't. They didn't have the means. Cade was lost to them. Fenn turned him away from the edge, put her arms around him, and laid her head against his shoulder. The tenderness of her touch was almost unbearable. He wanted to throw her sympathy back in